Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray. We're here in the Private Eye offices. I'm joined by Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop. We're going to be discussing the news of the last week and maybe the next week as well. And in the second half of this week's show, we're going to be talking to Solomon Hughes, who will be giving us a long-established expert guide to party conference from someone who's been there, done that, drunk the warm white wine. He'll be telling us about that later. But first of all, we should start with one of the biggest stories of the last week, maybe the one that's caught most public attention. It was on the cover of the last issue of the Mag. It's Russell Brand. And I think two of us here have met Brand in person. Looking at you, Adam.
Certainly not, no.
No, me neither. Right, well, we're the two who haven't. Ian and Helen, no, you
I'm,
have.
I'm guilty as charged, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I can't comment. You'll have to speak to my lawyers.
So I first met Russell Brand in 2013 when he guest edited an issue of The New Statesman, which I was then deputy editor, I think, by that point. Mm. I met him in the Savoy Hotel, and they had a sort of side room off the tea room. And he came in looking like a sort of huge gothic spider, all in black, and then all this clanky silver jewellery over the top of it. And he proceeded to tell us this anecdote about how cattle were trammelled in by cattle grids. But somewhere in Germany, some cattle had learned to walk over the cattle grid, like little steps, I guess. And then subsequently, other cows that had never met the original cows had also learned how to do this. And wasn't this proof that there was a gestalt animal consciousness? And at that, in retrospect, that was the point that I should have gone, well, it's been lovely to meet you. But yeah, I think it's really interesting to reflect on it. And I have been a lot this last week. The kind of allegations which he denies of sexual assault, I don't think were widely known about at the time. What we should have been more, I think, aware of was the kind of cranky nature of him. And I think pre-Jeremy Corbyn and that kind of some of that conspiratorial stuff seeping into the Labour Party, pre-Trump and the kind of Bannonite QAnon stuff seeping into the US Republican Party, there was a feeling that this sort of stuff that was quite fringe, it was like, you know, in the 90s when people were into dowsing and ley lines, it was kind of quirky and cute. And then that, over the course of the 2010s, metastasized into some quite dark places that now are absolutely in the mainstream of politics. So Ron DeSantis, who's one of the Republican contenders for president, went on Russell Brand's show not a month ago. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you subscribe on YouTube, don't you?
You're I am one of the six million awakening wonders. Yeah.
But I hope everybody else in the 6 million is like you and is doing it for critical purposes. Otherwise, it's too depressing. You also use the word metastasize, which I last saw in Russell's statement. I'm just saying.
That's where I get all my long words. Baroque is my favourite one.
Yeah, this is morphic resonance. People all over the world are using the word metastasize, despite having
it's
never heard of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's egregious.
But I think it's really interesting. So he was an absolute nightmare to work with in the sense that, for example, the Style Guide at the time, if you were talking about God, you had to cap up he and his. We had a religious chief sub who insisted on this. But he didn't want to do that. And there was quite a long back and forth about whether... And I was thinking, why am I arguing about capping up he in the sense of God with this? Does he not have anything else on? But when he was a Guardian football columnist, he was notorious for filing very late and being a nightmare with the subs. And I think the thing that's interesting about that is it does actually speak to the kind of other allegations, right, which is it's about stars and what is tolerated by stars. And like the quote, I would say, of the 2010s is that Donald Trump, you know, when you're a star, they let you do it. Because when you watch that Dispatches program, you know, the idea that people were talking about, oh, well, we just won't have any women working on the program. We'll make sure he only works with men. Why were these accommodations being discussed around somebody? And it's because commercial considerations mean if someone's a star, they get to do all this other stuff that they would never normally get away with.
Well, I mean, I will admit, I sat next to him on Have I Got News For You? I've sat next to all sorts of people, you know, Rolf Harris, Jimmy Savile. I don't think it means anything. But it is notable that after he appeared on that show, and I think that was 2007, he immediately complained to the producers and summoned them to his dressing room and said that he hadn't been shown enough respect. And he was, I thought, pompous and cranky and sort of very, very unlikable. And I thought the long words were ridiculous. He's basically Mr. Malaprop. I've actually no idea why anyone is taking this man seriously. But he went to the toilet in the middle of the recording, which again, you know, most people certainly...
No, I'm just looking. I didn't know you were allowed to do that. I know the actor Brian Cox did it once, but I was like, he's 80, that's foreseeable. But I thought it was very much that you bludgeoned through like David Cameron in that meeting.
Absolutely, and men of a certain age are allowed to go to the toilet after a long recording. But he left in the middle. And to be honest, when he came back, the jokes about going to the toilet in the middle of a recording were fairly obviously drug-related and jolly amusing, I thought. But he didn't think they were funny at all. So again, a lot of people are saying, well, we were all fooled, it was the noughties, it was, everyone was like, well, not everyone was fooled, actually. A lot of people thought, you're absolutely insufferable.
Why did the TV work dry up, I think, is an interesting question. Had lots of people heard a kind of miasma, but they couldn't nail it down. Or, fundamentally, when you listen to that YouTube channel, the thing he always says, we and our show. Our show's had to move to Rumble. You know, this is where we do this. And all of his...
Are you proposing he's got puppet masters? Are there people behind the brand?
That's very true. I mean, he records it like in his shed in Henley. It's a very small puppet master. But yeah. But it is also... I think we have to accept now that kind of cult leaders used to be kind of in wacko and they had their disciples in the compound with them. Now YouTube and Rumble, they are the compound. And the whole sense is like, we're the only ones. He calls them awakening wonders. We're the enlightened. We're the only ones who know. Don't listen to the others. And you set yourself up as the unique source of authority. Mm. And then you can't be challenged, you know. His instant reaction to the allegations was not just denial, but, you know, he said, oh, people have been saying that they'll come to you eventually, Russell, you know, that you get too close to the truth, you'll be found dead one day, you know, which I was linking himself with Jeffrey Epstein in that sense, which is not something I would necessarily recommend to somebody.
I don't know if we're not putting a bit of a generous complexion on his career in retrospect, though, because, I mean, there's Brand 1.0, who's the heroin addict who gets sacked from MTV. Then there's Brand 2.0, who comes back and does every panel show going and all the Channel 4 Big Brother spin-offs and things. My recollection is then that he went off to Hollywood to be a massive, huge star, did about 3 films that were quite big, and then left Hollywood, suddenly wasn't toast of the town anymore. It also seems to be the point in his career where a lot of the really serious allegations that have been put in Dispatches and in the Sunday Times seem to be coming from that point, and people are a lot less keen to follow those ones up than they are things that might have happened at the BBC, I noticed. Mm. That, again, possibly we're coming back to the very, very expensive lawyers who tend to function in Hollywood more than they do around Broadcasting House.
But the other thing I found slightly unfortunate about the whole thing is that it became who's to blame for Russell Brand. It's a real problem in how it functions, right? Is that he was used all the way back in Saxgate, you know, as a way to bash the BBC and a way to bash Jonathan Ross as the highest paid employee of the BBC at the time, in a way that kind of Gary Lineker is now. That doesn't take away from the fact that what he did in Saxgate was appalling and abhorrent.
Yeah, and a lot of people did say so.
A lot of people did say so.
The BBC did do an inquiry into it, and they did sack him as well.
Right,
they?
But it is also kind of intensely tribal, right, which is the sense that I'm sure there are many people in equal positions on the right with those kind of allegations around them, or indeed people who, in comedy, with those kind of allegations around them that don't get this kind of publicity, but it's the use of someone as a kind of bludgeon. And maybe that is me being too soft because I'm one of the people who, you know, promoted him in his career. But it does seem to me there was a lot of score settling that went on in a slightly unpleasant way when it came out that wasn't really about the allegations themselves. It was who was to blame and who can we pin this on, who was our political enemy.
But now he's on the right. I mean, and again, I'm fascinated by your recounting of the truth. I mean, I want to know what truth Russell has got close to. There's a lot of people talking about, the way you tell the truth. About what? Which bits of truth has Russell revealed in his long career?
Well, I think it's really interesting. There's a book by Naomi Klein about her being constantly confused with Naomi Wolf, who went from feminist author to conspiracist. And in that, she's quite honest about the fact that some of the kind of left-wing criticisms of power that she does are a millimetre away from conspiracy theories. The only thing is that, you know, obviously, there was widespread child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. You know, some big conspiracies do turn out to be true, and investigative journalism proves them to be true. So what he's doing on YouTube is a kind of simulacra of investigative journalism, right? He's asking the questions, but never actually doing the reporting. I watched a lot of it for my BBC series, The New Gurus, and I kept screaming, put an FOI request in, Russell. Go and do a bit of magistrate's court.
That's like, really just nice. It's like a cargo cult of journalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's leaned a lot into COVID and vaccines, as everyone has in that alternative sphere. 15-minute cities, the Great Reset, which is the idea that the World Economic Forum put out a document saying, wouldn't it be nice if we built back in a slightly better way after COVID, has now turned into, they want to make you eat bugs. But as you say, that it does often end up in anti-Semitism, because the fundamental premise is that they, whoever they are controlling the narrative, and who are they, and they're a secret cabal running the world. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I've ever seen open anti-Semitism from Brand's channel, but titles will literally be something like, here's what they're not telling you. Mm. And there's always that sense that there's a kind of tiny clique that's actually controlling everything.
I mean, are we missing a trick not doing this at the magazine? I feel like we should be starting our own cult. There's a built-in audience. I mean, just the podcast. We could start with Page 94. And come up with a nickname like Awakening Wonders for everyone listening now. You know, like Doughty Truth Seekers or so. I'm just not getting a sleepy listeners. Sleepy listeners. There we go. If you're still awake while you're listening to this, we want you to join us. Good. Okay, great. All right, we'll tune in next time for more of that.
Come on, sheeple.
I'm not getting a lot of good reaction from this cult idea. I'm looking around, I'm seeing a lot of
concern. Because obviously it's far too close and we are actually people who are trying to tell you the truth.
If I'm the only one on this podcast not involved in the cult, I'm going to be really cross. If you guys are having secret hooded meetings without me, I'm going to be livid.
Imagine like in the school netball team, you're picked last for the cult.
How do you know about my netball record? Very upsetting.
But we find ourselves, and our readers have written in saying, one, Russell Brand has not been charged, tried. You can't just say he did it all. You know, which is a perfectly reasonable point. But the second point is then Russell Brand says there's no evidence, as though 3 years of journalists working to amass statements and get this story over the line isn't evidence. So where are we between those two positions?
One thing that's really interesting, I think, is a change, and maybe the BBC Explainer Unit is also part of this, is the fact that both the, I think, Channel 4, kind of, they went out and did a wide kind of podcaster about how we reported this, and there were several pieces in the Sunday Times and Times as well, how we reported the story. Like, here's how we do it. Like, here's how we check that the phone number is actually Russell Brand's phone number. You know, we check contemporaneously, did anyone make a police report? All of that kind of stuff. And I think there is now more of a kind of acknowledgement that you don't just hand down these tablets of stone in journalism. And, you know, the Sunday Times says it. There will actually not just people who just dismiss that, but for people that is on its face evidence that it didn't happen. Oh, well, that's what the main, you know, if it's in the mainstream media, it's false. People have got that starting assumption.
And the cows thing, the cattle grids, there's no truth in that.
As far as I know, I don't know about you, but I've been, it's in the decade since actually, to quite a lot of National Trust properties where the cows seem to be well penned still. So,
okay. Was he proposing this is big idea for a cover story?
It is a well trotted out theory, morphic resonance, about how, you know, like blue tits all learn to peck through milk bottles left on people's doorsteps at the same time. Anyway,
that's because there's milk inside them.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, he didn't do that. But and actually, the thing that's interesting about the issue is there were some really lovely pieces in there. There was a Rupert Everett piece about the changes in gay life during his time working in Hollywood. But there was also some, let's be honest now, retrospect, flat out kind of crankery, which I wouldn't publish now, and I don't. And I think we'd get a lot more trouble for publishing now. Like that is one thing in which the climate has changed.
Very glad you say, Helen, that the climate has changed, because it forms a perfect bridge to the next thing that we were hoping to talk about today.
Oh man, there's a place on the one show sofa for you, isn't there? There really is.
The Segway King is back in town. No,
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. livewithchampion.com.
I thought this was a relevant thing to talk about, that you know, Rishi Sunak has announced that, well, he's announced loads of things. Number one, on electric cars, very excitingly, we're going to be aligning with Europe, which I gather is the whole point of this whole thing we've just all been through.
So they were going to be banned from 2030, and that's now been pushed back to 2035.
Exactly.
And the car manufacturers seem quite annoyed about this.
Loads of them are really annoyed about it. I mean, we should get into the whole big, broad context of Rishi Sunak's great big, no, we can't do any of this reset in a bit. But yes, specifically on electric cars, the one car firm that really was happy about it was Toyota, because they haven't actually bothered to make the running for many, many years on electric cars. And they've said, well, going all in on hybrids, and then actually, no, we'll do hydrogen, which hasn't really come to pass yet. There are very, very few hydrogen cars on the streets of Britain.
I am sort of team, wasn't that, was in the Hindenburg?
Hindenburg variant.
Right. Feels bad.
Yeah, do you not see the Zeppelin cars? There are a few of them around, awesome. Not many.
You've got to look up, Helen. Yeah.
So yeah, and the whole context of Sunak's speech last week announcing a range of different measures was basically to say these are long-term decisions. We're looking all the way ahead to next year's election, and we're going to be, you know, we're taking decisions in that interest of those impossibly distant people.
So what else did he have then? He had pushing back the electric cars.
So electric cars pushed back. Home efficiency standards for landlords. You were going to have to, in a couple of years, raise your home's efficiency to a minimum, I think it was C rating. And that was going to cost landlords around the country, you know, a few thousand pounds each. And it would, in time, have saved all their tenants hundreds or thousands of pounds on their bills. That's been scrapped, along with, in a little sort of sneaky side move, the Energy Efficiency Task Force, which was 15 people who knew a bit about insulation and were set up this year and have managed to meet four times so far. Mm. And the government said, actually, no, we'll be dispensing with your services, which is another indication.
That seems quite efficient use of energy to not bother to actually meet very much.
Absolutely, yeah.
Didn't he also ban a load of things that no one had suggested? Like, he was like, well, we won't tax eating meat, and we won't ban your seven bins. And I was like, how many, what?
Compulsory car sharing, something which I don't think the swampiest of swampies has even... There's been no pitch on that at the Lib Dem conference over the weekend. And no, so yes, those changes have all been nixed, thank God. You know, the pate tithe has been completely scrapped. And it is a weird reset to make, the pitch being, no, we can't do these things, and these are all conservative targets, conservative policies.
Many of them brought in very, very recently.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, and also high-speed rail too, right? And all the legs, many legs, it will have no legs anymore.
No. It's going to be absolutely legless now, high-speed two. It's not going from outside Birmingham to near London, and we'll all be benefiting from that.
Is the overall message that we are incapable of doing anything at all?
Pretty
and
much.
Therefore we won't. It's not possible. It's all too hard. Vote for us.
Kind of, yeah. There's a strong whiff of that about.
But it's dressed up again, isn't it? In this sort of slightly conspiracy theorising appeal to that base vote in the Tory party of, you know, this is one in the eye for the green zealot and we won't be forced into doing this kind of thing. It's not just Russell Brand. It's everyone has latched onto this kind of narrative of this woke blob and this elite who are forcing us to do things that they aren't necessarily forcing us
They'll
to do.
They'll be fitting wind turbines to individual people's shoulder blades, and it's incredible. And we are going to put a stop to this nonsense.
But there is this weird energy. I mean, you were talking about the fact that the XL Bully Dog March ran into the Rejoin the EU March, ran into the ULEZ March, right? That there are these little issues. And there was a huge thing at the election before last about, you know, banning ivory sales and things like that. Sometimes these tiny kind of things that otherwise you wouldn't talk about very much become the site of intense fervour and sort of circulate on maybe on Facebook or other places like that. They don't rise to the level of attention. But I wonder how much of this is ULEZ, post-ULEZ, Uxbridge by-election fallout?
I think a fair bit of it is, although they've seen it as an area in which they can make a difference. You know, they can save however many seats they think they can save by doing it. I don't know if
a number of them have been fairly honest about this, saying, you know, we're not going to win on any of the actual issues. We'll try the culture wars.
Mm. Yeah.
And amazingly, clean air is now a hugely toxic issue in Britain. Is it?
Clean air is woke. That's the problem. Yeah.
Breathing woke.
But it is the tiny policies and the huge ones. I know I keep going on about more chessboards in parks because I think that's the funniest thing ever to have attracted prime ministerial attention. And then HS2, which is the future of, you know, how industry moves around this country. I mean, it's a really significant one.
But coming up with a compromise that pleases absolutely no one may be the defining characteristic. I mean, the fact is that this train will now go from somewhere not really up north to somewhere outside London, and you'll have to get a replacement bus into London. I mean, it's going to take you longer than it would have done in 1850, I think. I think probably it's slightly faster. But it's just a mess, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, why not scrap the whole thing? I mean, there's probably a good case for that.
Because they poured so much money into it already, haven't they? And then the only solution to that, I mean, this is, Boris Johnson literally said, the last time, again, this is one of these stories that seems to come around every couple of years now, are we going to finish HS2 or not? But the last time, Johnson actually said, we've poured so much money into the hole now, we've just got to keep going with it. That's where it ends up. I mean,
and there is a proposal of delaying the next leg, so the Birmingham to Manchester leg, by 7 years, which seems even worse than a straight yes or no, as in, we'll take another 7 years over this. It's quite emblematic of the sort of general mood at the moment. I'm sure you guys all saw the last week's news about refurbishing Parliament, which...
20 billion or some insane figure. I mean...
is now going to be punted until after the next election.
Which reminds me of every time you watch Grand Designs and they always think, oh, we'll be under budget, and then it comes out. And it's like, well, if that's 20 billion is the upfront budget, then it's going to cost your entire GDP for the next 7 years. I just don't understand it.
Why don't they just kick them out of Parliament and put them in one of the tunnels that they've already dug for HS2, and they can just live there for a while.
The Mole Parliament.
Well, there's actually a rather fine cartoon in the Eye recently of a rather larger Bibby Stockholm moored outside Parliament, where they could equally well just do it from there.
Sure, I hear it's very luxurious.
Hot and cold running Legionnaire's disease, yeah.
I was interested to read the papers this week that, depending which one you read, said either... poll setback for Sunak after he does U-turn, or huge bounce for Sunak after he does U-turn. I mean, presumably time will tell, but we're not getting a very reliable guide as to what people actually think about dropping the green stuff, which, as you pointed out on previous podcasts, we've been here with every Conservative government, Johnson, Cameron. They start pretty green, and then the election comes near, and they go, oh, no.
I think we should move on. This is a good policy workshop, and I think I'm sure we'll come back to it. There was a story in the last issue of the magazine. I think it was yours, Adam. It was headline BAME game. Mm. And it was just so interesting about the way journalism works. I thought we should briefly cover
the way journalism in inverted commas works. Yes, yeah, 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 yeah. Well, I was surprised by the extent of this, but yes, it turns out that an awful lot of those YOY columns that appear under enormous picture bylines in the Daily Mail are not, in fact, written by the person whose picture byline is at the top of them. And this emerged when a number of BAME commentators were asked to put their names to pieces about the Notting Hill Carnival, which actually were being drafted for them by a number of 60 or 70-year-old white men in the Mail office writing pieces that effectively began, "Why I, as a black woman?" Which is one of those things that I don't think it had occurred to anyone at the Daily Mail. It sounds completely mad, doesn't it? But
it's staggering. And it was the purported writer of one of these pieces who
blew the whistle on it. Yeah, indeed. And then we found two more people who'd been asked to write effectively the same piece this year over the Notting Hill Carnival. And the piece duly appeared, saying exactly what the Daily Mail wanted it to say at the outset. But this is not uncommon, I've discovered. This is how an awful lot of the commentary on the Daily Mail works. And part of that is because the mad kind of need for people to have opinions very, very quickly when close to deadline, isn't it?
I, unfortunately, after you told me this story, I went, oh, did people not know that's how it happened? I felt very guilty. I've been sitting on this explosive secret since I left the Daily Mail in 2010. I worked on the features desk there for a year. And basically what would happen, obviously it's a different editor now, but under Paul Dacre, there would be a series of editorial conferences. There was something called pre-conference, and then there was pre-conference, and then there was conference, and then there was features conference.
Well, then pre-lash. And then...
Right. Is this daily?
Yeah, every day.
Four conferences.
How did anyone get
daily?
Anything done? We're just sitting in conferences
all the
time.
No wonder you need to ring up and say, can we put your name on
this?
That
is exactly why. So finally, you'd get the features commissioning about 11 a.m. in the morning when all of this was done. And then you would want to see copy by about 3 or 4 p.m.
Right.
And so obviously the regular staff writers were used to that level of churn. But if you're a normal civilian outside, you know, that is way short a time to write 1,000 words. So the thing, they would be ghosted. So you would talk them down the phone to people. And some of them are incredibly, like, the skill level involved was very high. I remember one of the writers, he was on a family holiday in France and he pulled over in a lay-by, I don't know if his family were in the car, and sort of took down this thing and then bashed out why I, as a, you know, as a Polish person, think there are too many Poles in Britain or whatever it kind of was. And then obviously you had to wait for, everything had to be printed out in 12 point... Times New Roman, double-spaced with quite wide margins, where it would go through to Paul Dacre in his office. He would then write on it in his fountain pen, summon you in and give it back to you. He would enact his changes. And then, over the course of several hours in the evening, a series of ever more impressively paid men would workshop a headline on it.
To commission an opinion piece whose only function is to reflect the opinions of the editor from start to finish is quite odd. I mean, maybe did it ever occur to anyone that the reason most people don't have opinions that quickly is they don't have opinions?
I remember once suggesting that actually that we had two sides of a particularly thorny issue, and this was given very short shrift. The Daily Mail does not entertain debate. The Daily Mail has one opinion. Thank you. But yeah, it makes for a very successful formula because, as you say, this Dominique Samuels piece was a kind of classic, you know, this is a poor reflection on black culture, right? And if you get a 70-year-old white guy to write that...
The Notting Hill Carnival.
Yeah. It reads very differently than if it seemed to come from within the community. The best thing about that is that Dominique Samuels appears to have had this awakening of not wanting to be a right-wing commentator because she went to Amsterdam and got really high. Did you get this part of the story?
This part of the story, I don't know.
Yeah, she wrote a Medium piece about
this. Sounds magnificently libelous.
Quote, plant medicine is what made her realise that she didn't want to write for the Daily Mail anymore.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Because she had, I think the point that was mentioned in the eyepiece, that the money is really good for doing this, to be ventriloquised effectively.
Yeah, so £800 to talk down something down the phone
and
for half an hour, and then it turns up with your picture on it.
And to be fair, the headline, Why I, as a 70-year-old white man, don't like the Notting Hill Carnival, does have it's making a slightly different point.
It's not quite so newsy, is it?
No.
What's up with modern music these days, writes man?
We should come on now, finally, to the so farewell then, or kind of au revoir then, to Rupert Murdoch, who's stepping down as head of News UK.
And let's get this right, he is transitioning.
That is
his choice of word.
Yes. His time of life. Good for
him. The age of 92, he is transitioning to the position of chairman emeritus. Whatever the hell that means.
His new pronouns will be sir and sir. Yeah, okay.
Wow. Yeah, so farewell then, Dirty Digger. Or is it really? I mean, he's moving on from the position of chairman of both Fox and News Corp and handing over. Big surprise. It's a complete outsider who just happens to have the surname Murdoch. It's Lachlan. Lachlan was in pole position and takes the Tom Wamsgans position from Daddy.
But isn't he actually more to carry on the succession theme, supposedly the mythology is that he's more like Roman, right? In that he is kind of chaotic, he's totally on board with Fox News going in its shrieky,
he's the very, very he's
direction.
The one whose politics are rumoured to be even further to the right than Rupert, certainly. He's very on board with all of that Fox
right
stuff.
Than Rupert's previous girlfriend. The one who thought Tucker Carlson was the Messiah.
Possibly not that far.
The one who did.
Do you think Lachlan was worried that she was going to get the job at the last minute? She was going to come in and pip him to the post.
I believe that entirely. It was the prayer sessions over coffee and the gun-toting former police evangelist. I think the children thought, you know, there's someone even more suitable than us.
Well, James Murdoch, who was the other contender, has come out as a sort of lefty in recent years, hasn't he? And spoken out publicly against Fox News's reporting of environmental issues in particular. But that seemed to coincide with the point at which it became fairly obvious to James that he was not going to get the job and that he needed to establish a slightly different reputation for himself. Right. Elizabeth, who was the other contender, ducked out of the business a few years ago. And it's always said she decided to go her own way. Well, she went her own way by selling her production company to her dad for an enormous and eye-watering amount of money that was so much that the shareholders, who usually stay fairly silent, but the shareholders whose names are not Murdoch, of which there are a few at News Corp, objected to it and had to come to a settlement with them over that a few years ago. So the really interesting kind of division of the spoils is going to come when Rupert is not just transitioning to watching daytime telly with his slippers on, but when he actually...
Transitions to the other side,
yes. And
just no sign of it.
It's never. Well, he said, didn't he, when he announced the engagement that was then called off, he said it was great to be entering the second half of his life. She's just 184. Wow. But his mother, Elizabeth Murdoch, the older Elizabeth Murdoch, she did live until 106. So, you know, we could still have an awful lot of Rupert hanging around. And it came like a veiled threat, didn't it, in the email to all staff, was he said, I will be in your countries and offices on Friday afternoons. And I will
I can guarantee you that I will be involved every day in the contest of ideas. Our companies are communities, and I will be an active member of our community. I'll be watching our broadcasts with a critical eye, reading our newspapers and websites and books with much interest, and reaching out to you with thoughts, ideas, and advice. How threatening does that sound?
Reaching out, yeah.
It's not really a resignation letter, is it? It's a letter saying, I'm still here. And in a sense, watching.
Yeah, I think it is. This I thought was really interesting. We talked about Russell Brand and all the rest of it. But the line in Rupert's farewell note where he just says, elites have open contempt for those who are not members of their rarefied class. Most of the media is in cahoots with those elites, peddling political narratives rather than pursuing the truth. I mean, to talk about elites is quite something coming from literally the most successful and powerful hereditary regime in the world. I mean, I was thinking about, is there any... The Sultans of Brunei don't have power like the Murdochs did. The Kims in North Korea don't either. I mean, in terms of actually straddling the globe, a business that you've inherited from your dad and that you're now passing on to your son, to have the brass neck to then talk about elites is just extraordinary, isn't
it?
And
to say the elites are in cahoots with the media. You own most of the media, Rupert. The point of your entire life has been to buy it all up.
Are we the elite?
We're the mainstream media, mate.
Oh, so we are the elite?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Where's my private jet?
Mm. Where's my helicopter?
Just a kind of bizarre thing where people with objectively much nicer houses with me keep telling me that I'm the elite. I don't even have a shed in Henley where I can make mad podcasts.
You don't even have a hydrogen-fueled car.
I don't. No. I'm nothing. I'm none of this.
You can come around and sit in my shed anytime you want to, Helen.
Can I try some plant-based medicine in your shed? That's what I hear happens.
Well, this all goes to prove I'm paying people about the right sort of level.
Ian, Helen and Adam there. Thanks to all of them. Now, we come to conference season, which is well underway at the moment. The Lib Dem conference has already happened. As we record this, the Conservative and then the Labour one are yet to come. And one of the Eye's conference veterans is Solomon Hughes, who's been writing about party conferences and what goes on at them for the Eye for many years now. But beyond all the main speeches that happen at conference, I thought it would be fun also to talk a bit about the corporate activity, the marquees, the presentations, the displays, the lounges that surround the main conference activity. And Solomon is a particular expert on those. Here he is.
I was just looking at the timetable just to get an idea of what they are. I mean, some of those stalls would be political ones. You'd have Conservative Friends of the NHS would have a stall at the Conservative Party with friends like that. Yeah. Who needs enemies, you might think. But also you'd find Sainsbury's, and this is what Sainsbury's say in the timetable. Relive your childhood with our farm-to-work Scalex tricks. Race around the track to experience how we contribute to the UK food system and our support for British farmers, customers, colleagues and communities nationwide. So you can play Scalex tricks at the, you know, with the little slot racing cars at the Conservative and Labour conference, which is, I mean, that's kind of the flavour of it. It's big corporates treating our political representatives like they were childish idiots. How it's going to be different this year is, I think the Conservative one, well, I'm expecting it to be as big, but I'm expecting them to be a bit bamboozled, because there'll be a party probably looking at themselves on the way down and not quite sure how to scrabble back up. And for Labour, what's happening is all that kind of corporate energy that we've been watching for a couple of years since Keir Starmer became leader, all that corporate energy seems to be reaching some kind of crescendo. So the to be honest, not so much the corporate trade fair, but the kind of lobbying meetings and lounges and all that kind of kit and caboodle around that, I'm expecting to be a bit more intense. That's what I'm expecting, but of course, we shall see when I get there.
And is the prospective benefit for the companies that are booking these enormous marquees, as you say, simply to catch the attention of the people who either are currently or might be in government? I mean, is there anything else to it than that, or is it really that simple?
I would just think, I mean, Heathrow, I've always, for every year I've been for like maybe a decade, have this kind of, they set up the Heathrow Lounge, and it's if you sign in and persuade them that you're an important enough person, you can go in there and get free cups of tea and sit down, which, you know, the conference is really busy, that kind of thing is at a premium. And they've been running this as if it were a departure land, as if it were an executive departure land, and they've been running it for ages. And it's sort of a bit weird, because actually even a nice departure lounge isn't that much fun. But anyway, they've been running it for years. But it's just at a basic level, as long as Heathrow can be have a huge, comfortable lounge offering coffee, tea, whiskey, cake and what have you to MPs, council leaders and all their hangers-on, and a green group can't, we're not going to roll back air travel, are we? And we haven't done. I mean, maybe that's a simplistic way of viewing it, but, you know, we can see what's happened.
Well, we also haven't got a third railway at Heathrow either, no. So there's a sense in which it's doing limited good, clearly.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But, yeah, it's firefighting.
Yeah. I mean, Lloyds run the parliamentary lounge, which is a little bit more sophisticated. You're going to get there if you're what they call a parliamentarian, which doesn't just mean an MP. It's anyone they say is important. And you can only get into that. It's a kind of weird thing, because the conference itself is obviously segregated off from the country because it's behind the Ring of Steel. You have to be a delegate, get a pass, get approved by the police and what have you. And then when you get in there, there's kind of even another layer of exclusion. And Lloyds, like I say, Lloyds Bank run the parliamentary lounge now at both parties, I'm expecting. I'm not 100% sure this year, but they were last year. And it's just, yeah, they've bought exclusive access, you know, so they've just bought lobbying access, as simple as that, you know. There's a counterbalance, isn't it? Parties need votes. Parties need press coverage, parties need members, but I mean, it's they buy their way in, and not just in, they buy their way into the centre of the conference.
Is there any kind of sniff test applied to companies who the parties in question might not want at the conference or not want to have a presence there? So are there any which are just a bit too embarrassing to have?
I tell you what, actually, I think in terms of the exhibition, because the exhibition is relatively public, there is, because what happened before is like some of the unions at some point have demonstrated against people, you know, physically demonstrated inside Labour conference against stalls that were run by people who were anti-union. So obviously there is a kind of embarrassment test there. But in terms of meetings, I just don't know that there, if there is, it's they've got a very bunged up nose. So, I mean, a couple of issues ago, you can get early bits of the timetable. The full timetable is now out now, but if you look in the right place, you can get early bits of the timetable. And for both the Conservatives and Labour, they were having the same meeting, in effect, paid for by Serco, the leading privatiser. Conservative one, it's not so surprising. I mean, you know, a Conservative MP's brother chaired Serco for a long time. They really were reaching out to the Conservatives, you know, because the Conservatives believed in privatisation and they were the party of government. But for Labour, it's perhaps a little bit more striking, because when Serco ran the test and trace really, really bad, he got loads of money to run a COVID service that was really just money down a hole, I reckon. But nobody thought it was great. Labour really attacked them. Angela Rayner said, "Why are Serco and other outsourcing companies being rewarded for their failure?" By getting more contracts, she meant. And Rachel Reeves, so, I mean, you know, Rayner from the soft left, say, but Rachel Reeves not from the left of the party. She said test and trace shouldn't be being outsourced to a large private company like Serco, which has a poor track record and known links to the Conservative Party. So Rachel Reeves got very angry. And now Serco are going to be having a meeting right inside Labour conference with a Labour shadow spokesperson on the platform. I don't know. I mean, maybe I read that wrong. Well, maybe when Rachel Rees said she was angry that Serco had known links to the Conservative Party, maybe she more actually meant she was angry that they didn't have known links to the Labour Party. And now they're going to very much try
finally
and get them. Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the point.
Well, that's charitable.
Maybe I've just completely read that wrong. I mean, I tell you the one that I think did seem to cause a bit of trouble, both at Conservative and Labour, was a lot of the vaping firms said they were going to have a minister on their platform, and then the minister didn't turn up. So maybe vaping for a while was a bit awkward.
Was this last year, do you mean?
Yeah, last year and maybe the year before. I do remember turning up hoping, I mean, these didn't become stories in private eye, because I turned up hoping to find a minister there with a vaping sort of lobbyist, because the vaping meetings, seriously, they literally hand out vapes to the delegates, and you can see all the young delegates grabbing the vapes and then banjaxing themselves on nicotine afterwards, you know. So that would have been just a particularly ridiculous one, but my memory is that maybe the vaping ones don't pass the sniff test. I don't know, you know. Serco is good, vaping is bad. But I mean, in fact, now you said that, I will very much make an effort to report on all vape-related meetings to see where they stand on the sniff test.
So is the idea that if you're, let's say you're having a fringe meeting and you're running whatever kind of company, the big prize is to get a minister or at the very least an MP to appear at your meeting and discuss matters, and you're asking questions that your industry and in particular your company would like answers to.
100%. I mean, I've seen this change over time. Essentially, the corporates hire lobbyists to get close to ministers. The lobbyists then go to think tanks or similar and get them to arrange the meetings. That's the chain. All the think tanks hold meetings that are corporate sponsored, and that's the routine. So the Serco meeting is held by the Institute for Government, a kind of sort of bland centre. Well, actually, they seemed like quite a critical think tank of government machinery, but I think they've got a sort of rather bland kind of centrist heart, really. So they kind of folded for that. One point I would also make is that everything that happens in conference, it's like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, actually. Ministers have to have a list of who they've met to lobby them and so on and so forth. Conference is exempt from that. All the meetings they have at conference, they're not listed. So they could be partying all night long with, you know, drug company. But that, unlike their meeting, their official ministerial meetings, it is unrecorded. Except by me.
Well, that feels like a loophole.
Except by me if I happen to see it.
One other question I wanted to ask you. I bumped into someone recently who's going to be going to to both conferences, and who maintained that it's going to be a money-making opportunity for the Conservatives. Even for the Conservatives, even if the corporate interest has slightly drained away, they'll make millions of pounds out of conference. Can that be right?
Yeah, they do make money on it. Yeah, they do. I mean, you know, you can see that in the accounts of the parties. They make money. You know, you have to pay X amount just to have a stand. You have to pay Y amount to get... and I'm pleased to say, after a little blip, even the Conservatives do not charge journalists for passes. But yeah, all the corporates and lobbyists and, you know, charities and what have you, they have to pay to go in. They are money-making ventures, you know.
Finally, I suppose, I think it's possible that plenty of listeners to this podcast will be heading to conference, maybe some for the first time. What advice would you give to people simply to survive conference season with your faculties intact?
I wouldn't advise anyone to go to conference season and survive with their faculties intact. What is the point of going if you want to keep your faculties? I'd love to see hydrate. I tell you what I initially found, and this is I'm 60 years old now, but when I was younger and hungrier, I found that if you went to the late first Labour conferences in the early 2000s, that you didn't need to buy any food, because if you just went to the most grotesque meetings, the ones that were really sponsored by someone really unpleasant, the food would be much piled high, and it would be held in the poshest hotel, and the audience would be really small, because the only people there, you know, none of the members were interested in this, just the lobbyist and the poor minister or shadow minister who's dragged along. So you could feed yourself entirely on the basis of lobbying chicken. So that's one tip that doesn't necessarily work for Conservative conference. I would say when the Conservatives are out of government, actually the conference, Labour out of government, the conference remains big. The Tories out of government, which we may be about to see, the conference is still big-ish, but it shrinks down a greater degree. Strange enough, I guess Conservatives are just more interested in power, so a party out of power loses its thrill more, whereas Labour people are more interested in a cause, possibly a losing cause as well, so they still turn up even when they aren't getting anywhere.
You can have a factional argument at a conference, no matter what your governmental status. And that's...
I tell you what, actually, if you go to the Liberal Democrat conference, they're not... I don't go so often, but there's a reasonably large number. It's not as many. But there's quite a lot of people, and there isn't anything like the lobbying. So there you just have a lot of people talking with you know, very weak catering indeed, you know, so... Yeah, so my tip is go to awful meetings with good catering to sustain yourself. Hydrate. Do lose your mind, because, you know, I went to a festival and I came back as sensible as I went before. You know, that's not the spirit, is it?
Trebles all round for Solomon. Thanks very much to him for that, and we hope he brings his faculties back after conference season. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We hope you've enjoyed it. We will be back again in a fortnight with another one. Until then, go and buy Private Eye magazine. I think I've made myself clear. There are copies on newsstands, and there are subscriptions available online. Avail yourself of either of those, and you'll be doing a wonderful job for yourself and for us. Thanks again for listening. This episode was, as ever, produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.